Yep, 100 million.
Okay, that's all.
Okay, okay, colleagues, I'm going to open a meeting. It's Thursday, April 27th, 2017, and I'm going to open the meeting on the House Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee on Thursday, April 27th, 2017. We have two brief but excellent informational, and that's editorial.
You have license.
We have two brief but excellent informational presentations planned for you today related to the Oregon Promise and affordability initiatives. And I'm going to open an informational hearing on the Oregon Promise implementation. We're going to invite up the HEC and a few of our community colleges to talk to us today about the 2016 Oregon Promise wraparound support services efforts and also the data that's available to us now. There were a few terms into the Oregon Promise implementation. And we're going to start with Juan Baez Arevalo, the interim director. We've met in Ways and Means. He's the interim director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. Juan, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Juan Baez Arevalo, Interim Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. It's my pleasure to speak to you this afternoon about the Oregon Promise. Oregon Promise is, as you know, become very widely known throughout the nation. It was established by Senate Bill 81 of the 2015 session to provide a waiver of tuition for community college courses. The Oregon Promise, a last dollar program, so it is applied after federal and state aid. Students may be eligible for up to 90 credits attempted. The grant sizes range from the minimum of $1,000 up to $3,397 for the current academic year. And that maximum is set based on the average community college tuition. And the goal of the program is to increase community college enrollment, completion, and affordability for recent high school graduates and GED recipients. Now, this table provides you with the most current and expanded level of information that we have to date. As you can see, this table displays for you by expected family contribution. Expected family contribution is kind of an assessment that the federal government uses and the financial aid community uses to determine how much a family can afford to pay. And as you can see, we have the grant dollars dispersed for the fall, the grant dollars dispersed for the winter, the grant utilization rate from fall to winter, the number of recipients in the fall and the number of recipients in the winter, and also the retention rate from fall to winter. Mm-hmm. There is variation according in the various ranges of expected family contribution from one to another and from one term to another. I'd like to highlight that the majority of participants in the Oregon Promise have an EFC of zero. That's $0. So would be students who would be recipients of the Pell Grant, recipients of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and also recipients of the Oregon Promise. Their full number is 1,736. It dropped to 1,500 in the winter, and the retention rate is 86.4%. It is a good retention rate when we compare it to other historical notes from state grant programs. The next category is those with an expected family contribution of $1 to $4,999. And their retention rate is 91.9%. Very high, remarkable number. If you see the grant dollar utilization rate, and we added that category there for you so you can see, and that's that difference between the largest payout that we made in the fall to winter, and the variation depends on two elements, and that is the number of the students who transition from one term to the other, and also their level of participation academically, if they're part-time or full-time, that designates how much money we spent or disperse to those students. The following category of EFC from 5,000 to 9,999 about 1,000 students, 942 stayed with the program in the winter, and their retention rate at 88.5%. The following category, from 10,000 EFC to 19,999, 1,162 in the fall, and 1,027 in the winter term, with an 88.4% retention rate. As you can see, we have very strong retention rates. The average, it's 88.2% for all categories, and the average grand dollar utilization rate is 87.4%. Our team at OSAC will continue to monitor these categories. We'll continue to monitor from one term to another and from one year to another. And now I'd like to highlight the obvious fact that this is year one, mm-hmm. and we're talking about term one and term two of this program. And obviously, as the program matures, we will have data that can be compared from multiple terms and from multiple years in different categories, and also other variables, not just expected family contribution. I'll pause for a moment in anticipation of any questions.
I think those are very impressive. Are you sure that Representative Johnson didn't bump them up or something? I think that's very impressive, and I think we want to be sure that Tennessee and the other states see how good we're doing. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I think you all might have received a report from the HEC yesterday related to the Oregon Promise, but it had some of these same numbers. But they also included that this is approximately a 7% increase over comparable cohorts of students. So it's significant. And then you're going to even talk about wraparound services as well, which I think also will have a bearing on why those numbers are looking better than we might have expected.
Yes, indeed. And for the record, Mr. Vice Chair, there was no previous conversation with Representative Johnson.
Good, he didn't influence.
Conversation.
Representative Solomon.
Or influence of any sort. This is remarkable work, and this is, the retention rates are high, and the quality of that number that you see there is representative of the work that is being done at the community colleges, and I think they deserve a great round of applause of reaching out to the students, working with the students, making that first year experience very valuable, and the support, the wraparound services that they're getting.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Solomon.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I had a question in regards to, and I'm hoping that somebody can give me some clarity, because students that, I think this is a fabulous program, and often I talk to students about why are we not seeing a growing number of students trying this instead of going right for their four-year degree at a university? And why not do they have the ability? So my question and my comments are just wrapped up all together here. Mm-hmm. Are they able to do this, and then are they able to go on and still get a considerably decent tuition scholarship opportunity at a four-year college, so they can do the two here and then go here? A lot of students are saying that it's like they have to come in at that freshman year for the four-year, that it jeopardizes them to go this route.
So,
isn't my question where it's
no, no, no.
Worded?
It's a good question, Representative Solomon, Vice Chair Wisnett. Students can be dual enrolled, so that students can be, as long as the community college is the primary institution they're attending, mm-hmm. uh-huh. they can participate in this program. And if they're taking concurrently a course, for example, if they're enrolled at Lynn Benton Community College and then they're taking some courses at Oregon State, that can and does occur. We do have students who are co-enrolled or dual enrolled. Students who participate in the Oregon Promise can certainly take their credits and then look to transfer to a four-year institution after their 2 years. So those are decisions, I think, that at the student level, at the family level, when they look at the financial package mm-hmm. that is being offered to them by their college as a four-year institution, and then look at it in comparison to what the Oregon Promise offers to them, and I think they have a great option.
Follow up?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I think I'm most concerned where I hear folks they feel like they're jeopardized for that 4 year if they go this route. And you're saying they certainly can take this opportunity and then transfer to a 4 year. But it's that it's the scholarship. It seems to not be available coming in after this versus coming in as a freshman. Am I incorrect? Is that something that you're not hearing?
I think Representative Weiser was saying, I think the confusion or the concern might be where for Oregon Promise, you do have to enter and be enrolled at a community college within 6 months of your high school graduation. So postponing that entry currently, you know, could create that situation.
Oh, I want them to go here right away. Yeah. Sorry, that's like, sorry.
That's okay.
I'm just wondering, perhaps we, you know, from our end, we could do a better job at improving and communicating, clarifying those things for students and families as to dual enrollment and how that can work.
Follow up. Sorry. No, I think it's I'm just not being clear. If somebody else can jump in and explain, if they can figure out what I'm saying, is I love the idea of students being able to take this opportunity. Mm-hmm. But I would like to see it so that they can take this opportunity, save a considerable amount of money in their higher education debt load, and then transfer to a four-year college, but still have those scholarship opportunities at
the four-year college institution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'm hearing students saying that I ask students a lot. I say, why aren't you, look at this opportunity. This is an amazing program that we have here. And they say, well, it jeopardizes my scholarship for a four-year.
So it sounds like, if I'm interpreting correctly, that the four-year college institution is saying if you don't start, you know, in the fall instead of being at the community college, that they would lose whatever scholarship offer or package that they're being provided. Obviously, those are institutional-level decisions, but some institutions do allow a deferment of maybe a year or something like that. But those are very much an institutional-level decision.
Representative Johnson, you want to help?
Well, and just I would assume that students still would be eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant as a entering junior or senior, correct? But being an Oregon Promise student for the first 2 years wouldn't exclude you from that opportunity, right?
Representative Johnson, that is correct.
That is some grant aid. Okay. But then if there were another package available from the institution, I think that's just on a student-by-student basis as they apply, come in as an incoming junior. I'm sure there must be opportunities for financial aid there. I see some heads nodding.
So those would be individualized student packages.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think their opportunities would be diminished, in my understanding.
Thank you. So, Director, are you going to talk a little bit about the mentoring and how we spent the mentoring and how that's, you know, is that going? Or is
that coming up next.
Okay.
I'll just mention in closing that at the end of this academic year, we will have a great deal more information and we'll be able to report to you additional details about this program, including the eligibility for and the size of the federal Pell Grants that the participants of the Oregon Promise received, as well as the total amount of Pell Grant dollars that came into our state as a result of this program. So you notice the largest number was in that zero category. Those are students who we obviously would be eligible for that federal Pell Grant, as well as other details and analysis, including the prior dual credit enrollment, and then any sort of dual enrollment that we would have of students who are attending perhaps an LBCC or an Oregon State or a PCC as their primary institution and a Portland State. So we'll be able to have some of those analysis for you. And thank you for clarifying the question. I understand now that that gray circumstance that a family may find themselves.
Before you leave, sir, is my work on the Ways and Means. How I haven't looked at the whole thing or looked at it completely. How did you come out on the cut budget? Is that did Oregon Promise get cut at all?
We're not done yet, Representative.
Okay.
Vice President, we're still going through that. In fact, we do have a presentation scheduled, and I think in that it's being organized. Look forward to reviewing those numbers with you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll call up then Director Crane and Jim Yerstrom. Is that close?
Perfect.
Thank you. Tell the president I missed her today. She didn't get down here. She's back there? Okay.
Yeah.
So, welcome. I got to bring all three up. Okay, John. Okay. Please identify yourself. Either one want to start first, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Vice Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Crane. I'm the Director of Community College and Workforce Development at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I will start off this morning and talk about House Bill 4076, some of the highlights from the report and how the money was spent, essentially. As background, House Bill 4076 from 2016 allocated just under $1.7 million for first-year experience to help support community colleges support Oregon Promise students when they came in. One of the requirements for Oregon Promise recipients is that in order to maintain eligibility for the grant, they have to participate in a first-year experience. That first-year experience is to be identified by the community college and then reported back to the commission. So it was up to the community college to define and determine what the first-year experience was for their students. We did not define that for them. The funding itself ended up being just under $83,000 for each community college. Portland Community College received four allocations of $83,000 because of their four campuses. So the total was $1,659,800. And it was to provide support services for persons who enroll in courses offered at a community college in Oregon within 1 year of earning either a high school diploma or equivalency. The money was required to be spent on three sets of activities: a first-year experience, a student success team, and thirdly, a professional development for faculty and staff that would enable them to provide intentional strategic intervention for students. This first-year experience had to have support elements for the students, and professional development needed to be provided for community college faculty or staff to provide these strategic interventions, as I mentioned. The report itself that you have before you is the second of two reports that were required to be submitted by the HEC to the legislature, and focuses on expenditures and provides some information about how the first-year experience programs were structured at each of the 17 community colleges. In looking at the expenditures, to date, as of the end of March, 64% of the allocation had been spent by the colleges. All 17 have plans to spend down the remaining funds by the end of the biennium, June 30th, 2017. So when I'm talking about the way the money was spent, I'm talking about the actual expenditures that have been made to date. The largest investment area for the colleges was personnel. 57% of the money went to paying personnel costs at the institutions. That included hiring career coaches, paying academic advisors, financial aid assistants, student tutors, as well as the faculty and staff that teach and organize first-year courses or first-year experience activities designed to help retain students at the institution and give them the skills necessary to be successful in college. In looking at some of the institution-specific expenditures, this was the large personnel was the largest category for 12 of the 17 community colleges. The second largest category of expenditures, 20% of the total, was professional development. This includes both professional development activities that took place on campus to support faculty and staff, but it also included providing support for faculty and staff to attend student success or advising conferences in Oregon or in other places, or to support contracts with organizations such as AVID. Chemeketa and Lynn Benton used some of their money for that. Mount Hood already has a contract with AVID. Or Achieving the Dream. That would be Tillamook Bay Community College, Oregon Coast, spent some money on Achieving the Dream contracts. So for three of the 17 community colleges, professional development was the largest area of investment. As it turns out, that was at Tillamook Bay, Southwestern Oregon Community College, and Oregon Coast Community College. I'm just conjecturing, but in particularly coastal rural communities where there might not be a large pool of potential hires, the decision was made to invest in existing staff who were likely to stay in the community and make sure that they had the skills necessary to support the students both this year and for coming years. The third largest category of investment, about 10% of the total, was IT development. This was driven by two community colleges, Blue Mountain Community College, as well as Columbia Gorge, which focused on two different activities. For Blue Mountain, they used a portion of their funding to develop an early alert system so that they would know which students were falling off in terms of their grades or attendance, so they could intervene more quickly. Columbia Gorge specifically used their funds to develop an online portal for orientation advising in order to connect with students throughout the region so that they could have access to their first year experience and advising information. The fourth area of investment was supplies. This was about 8%, and this went to support activities related to advising, retention, coming up with programming, providing the necessary materials to have first-year orientation events. In the case of Treasure Valley Community College, they hired student ambassadors to welcome new students to campus. Clatsop Community College, they focused their approach on service learning and student and community engagement, trying to connect students to the community in order to aid with retention efforts. And they redirected some of their funding to provide textbook support directly for Oregon Promise students when they realized that that was a need that they identified in their community. Just one piece of context that I think is important to note is that all 17 community colleges are in the midst constantly of trying to acquire funding wherever possible to meet the needs of the students in their community and to recalibrate how they're serving students and figure out where different funding streams can provide the maximum support. A couple of the colleges, Tillamook Bay Community College and Central Oregon Community College in particular, had recently received federal Title III grants, which was designed to strengthen institutions and help them serve low-income students. So they used this money to tie in some of the efforts that they already had through the Title III and were able to use both state and federal money to provide additional support and bolster their ability to serve students. Two colleges, in particular, Rogue and Central Oregon Community College, had already been thinking about restructuring the first-year experience writ large and really trying to reframe how to think of the whole first year coherently to make sure that students connected to the institution had the supports all throughout. And this funding helped accelerate some of those efforts. In terms of the first-year experience itself, looking across the 17 colleges, there's some variance, but there were some clear trends that I noticed looking at them. One, almost all the colleges created this as a one-term experience. There were a couple that started this as a partial-term experience, but had additional support spread out throughout the year to connect students with advisors or to connect them to the institution. Clatsop Community College made this a two-year experience focused on leadership and community engagement. And in general, these courses were open to any students. They were mandatory for Oregon Promise students. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, they were also mandatory for other first-time, full-time students, not necessarily Oregon Promise students. And it was always accompanied by mandatory advising to help students figure out what their career trajectory was, what courses they needed to take. The first-year experience, again, was usually but not always a 1 to 3 credit course that was offered in the first term. And the areas that the courses focused on were around developing study skills, navigating the college, financial literacy, critical thinking, leadership, and career exploration. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have, or I can turn it over to my colleagues from Chemeketa Community College and Mount Hood Community College.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I don't know how many committee members you received this report yesterday, but I really appreciated the detail, college by college, and it really is amazing the diversity of you know, services that colleges have come up with. And to keep in mind, this has only happened with a 83K investment. It's really amazing. But I really, really appreciate the just uniqueness of each college to try to fit their culture. So great report. I mean, it's exactly what we were looking for and we were hoping for when we passed that bill in February of last year. So great work.
Great. Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, thank you for that. As I said, all 17 colleges are always focused on student success and retention efforts, and this funding enabled them to look at their community, look at their college, and figure out how they could take this funding and meet whatever their next most immediate need was for supporting students.
Any other comments or questions? Rep. Whitman?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like the two colleges did the Chemeketa and Mount Hood did the ADVID. So we're going to hear from them on that. No college, or did some of the colleges use putting them with upper class, second year student or something? Was any, program used where they dedicated, pick someone that's been here a year or something to peer guidance, and peer mentoring? Is that no one did that? I can't.
Vice Chair Wisnitz, Chair Reardon, members of the committee, there are student support services that support all students, but because this was focused on the first year experience, that's what we looked at. I think some of these initiatives around mentoring in particular extend beyond that, but I'll ask my colleagues to address that more specifically.
One quick follow-up then, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm interested in, a rough estimate of how many hours were spent, in providing the first year experience training and, per student. Is it, was it a 1 3-hour course twice, once a week or once every halfway point or something like that?
Representative Wisnitz, Chair Reardon, I can provide you that information afterwards. The first year experience courses varied from non-credit online experiences that went throughout the year to 1 credit one term, 3 credits one term, 2 credits two terms, but I can put that together and provide you a more detailed breakdown.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you do student surveys at the end of this of the services and kind of get data from the students? I always want to call them kids. They're not all kids.
Chair Reardon, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission does not. The institutions may.
Well, I'm sorry. That's what I didn't phrase it accurately.
I don't know. Maybe Mount Hood does. And
others, yes.
And Chemeketa does to some extent.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Graham.
Chair Reardon, Vice Chairs Alonzo Leon and Wisnant. For the record, my name is Jim Ustrom. I'm Vice President of Instruction and Student Service at Chemeketa Community College here in Salem, and also throughout the district, and Brian Clem's neighbor. So if I could, I would like to just address quickly, Representative Solomon, we have really wonderful working relationships with all the public and private four-year institutions for transfer, and what I do know, I meet regularly at Western, and that there are specific grants that are and scholarships for transfer students only in addition to those. So I know that each institution is different in what they do, and there may be some of those scholarships that aren't available if you don't enter in as a freshman, but I bet there's as many that are available specifically because you're a transfer student. And so same thing at Corbin, same thing at Linfield. And so in the past few years, a lot of work has been done to create the
seamless transition.
Right. So there's that. Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Wisnant, we asked about how many hours at Chemeketa specifically that we consider the first year experience, not just that 2 hours a week course that a student may take in their first term, which would be 22 hours in the frame of the term, but they also, we require orientation, which is another 2 hours when you look at what we do there, and also mandatory advising through your first 3 credits, and you must meet with an advisor 3 times a term. And so when you add up those hours, that one-on-one relationship they have is probably 35 hours. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
So that's our experience, and it varies from institution to institution. I'd like to share very quickly that we're really excited by what Oregon Promise has done for our district. We serve the second largest number of Oregon Promise students at Chemeca, and we have just reached, as of this Monday, 1,079 students that have utilized the Oregon Promise at Chemeca. Of that, we're real excited by that. And we know specifically, looking at the trends over the last 5 years of how many students graduate from high school in the district, how many students have come to Chemeca, that we're experiencing probably a 22% to 25% increase in direct from high school students this year, which we align with the Oregon Promise. The other little tidbit that I would share is that we're a Hispanic-serving institution. 25% of our credit students claimed Hispanic on when they admission form. Of the Oregon Promise students, it's 32% to 33%, so even a higher population there. So we're excited by what the Oregon Promise has done for us. What I'd like to also share is, of those Oregon Promise students, something that we were not quite prepared for and delighted by was that the average grade point average of the Oregon Promise student coming to Chemeca was 3.25 out of high school, out of a 4.0 GPA. And so that is higher than what Tennessee exhibited. It's, and so we were pleased with that also. The confounding thing, and we should have been aware of this, but that the average student coming in on the Oregon Promise had 19 to 20 college credits coming out of high school coming into the college. So you think about that too. A quirk that I'll tell you is that 2 students had 90 credits.
Awesome.
How they got those, and they were not eligible for the Oregon Promise. The Oregon Promise is up to the first 90 credits, and so that was something that we're helping to educate students better on as they enter in, that those credits they earn in high school affect the total 90 credits. But so we're working on that, and by the end of winter term, we had a total of 24 students who had earned 90 credits already toward, unfortunately, they weren't all exactly in line to be an AAOT or a transfer degree, and so they're still there. But you can see how people accumulate credits over this and working. So we're working to better advise students when they're in high school. We spend about a third of the support money, and Chair Ridden and Representative Johnson, I want to recognize we so appreciate the wraparound monies that we were able to get in this one-time experience. It really did help us to leverage our own money and to accelerate some of the things we were doing. And so we already had in place mandatory advising, but it let us infuse that a little bit stronger. We also had a first-year experience course. Not every community college did, but we were lucky that we did a 2-credit course. What we're doing now is we are revising it to make it more vital to the students that are coming in and looking at the high school students, because they continually change. So looking at the dynamics of that, so it's allowed us to do that. We spent one-third of the money that came to us through this on an agreement with Avid, which you mentioned. And so the Avid consultancy is doing 3 different things for us specifically. Number one, we really wanted to focus on better professional development for our faculty on how to better engage students so that it would affect not just the Oregon Promise students, but all the students they were teaching. And so Avid provides that as one element of what they do. The second piece was really they have a very strong curriculum around first-year experience courses, so they are coming in consulting to revise and update our first-year experience course. And so the benefit of both those things are it's going to last far beyond the 1 year that we're doing with this grant money, and so much so that the college is continuing for 2 further years with Avid on other funds to continue that work. And then the third piece on that is they are coming in as a consultancy to look at our Study Skills Center, which is adjacent to our Tutoring Center, to help that to turn that into more like the Avid centers that are in the high school. So we have a lot going on, and we've been juggling that that contract and the money we're doing to really focus on that. So
we have a question here. Rep.
Belanto. Thank you, Chair. So my question, first of all, I am so excited that the Oregon Promise is working so well for Chemeca, and it sounds like Malhood as well. Looking forward to your presentation. My question is around retention and persistence. You know, we've had students now probably take the scholarship for 1 year. I'm really interested in learning how that's helping students stay in college and persist or you know, retention purposes. So if you have any data on that, I'd love to hear it. And certainly for Mount Hood as well when you do your presentation. Thank you.
Chair Reardon and Vice Chair Alonzo Leon, we're keeping track of that, and we enter them in as a cohort and are following them through. And what we have found is those students that are the Oregon Promise students, the persistence from fall to winter term was much more along the lines of it was over 90%, 91%, compared to just less than 80 for the non-Oregon Promise students. What we've done now, of course, now we've gone into spring term, and we're in the mid-80s, so that's a very strong trend. The most interesting thing, I think, out of all this is that of the just over 1,000 or 1,050 Oregon Promise students, close to 900 were full-time, 895 or something were full-time from the beginning, and then others were part-time. We had more students transition from part-time to full-time by winter term than we ever have had from out of that supported pocket of students, too. So that's a positive thing.
My follow-up question, and this is more specific towards our GED students. I know that we've had an increase in GED graduates going on to college, and we really, when I was a GED minister, we really encouraged them to apply for the Oregon Promise. And I'd love to, if you guys don't have that information out, but in the near future, to hear the participation and retention rates of those GED students.
Chair Reardon and Vice Chair Alonzo Leon, we did not have a huge amount of GED students. In the first go-round, we had 16 of the 1,000, but we're up to 20 GED students that took advantage of the Oregon Promise. The other piece that may be of interest to all of you is that, you know, if you weren't eligible to apply for the federal financial aid and you went through the other process with the Oregon, we had 25 students who were able to come to school that weren't eligible for federal financial aid also. So lots of different opportunities for different people that hadn't existed before.
Yeah. Follow-up, Chair. So it was just the numbers that you just referenced are specifically to Chemeketa?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. And do we have any data statewide as far as GED graduates going on to post-secondary using this scholarship?
Yes, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Alonzo Leon, we do, not with me today, but we can certainly provide that information.
Perfect.
As a follow-up for you.
Perfect.
Chair Reardon, Vice Chairs, if I could offer one last thing. I didn't mention this, and I think it's important, that this money has also allowed us to move ahead an initiative that will affect all of our students, and we were able to create an early alert pilot. And what that is within the first couple of weeks of the term, we connect with all the faculty and ask if they're having issues with students from not attending, to not turning in their assignments, et cetera. And then we were able to already the staff involved, the student affairs staff that work with advising, were given the names, and we made personal contact with those students that weren't doing so well. And we used a couple cohorts, the TRIO cohorts, but also the Oregon Promise students. And there was an amazing amount of contact with those students. And we're in our third term of it and refining it so that we hope to make it generalized to all student population in the next couple of years. But it's this money that helped us generate that project in a faster route than we could have.
Rep. Solomon?
Thank you, Chair. A couple of things. I am so impressed with the wraparound services and the amount of the things that you are putting into place so that make sure that our students are successful. And, you know, so much, at least back in the day, people would say when you were going to college, oh, it's just totally common for you to change your major five times or this or that. And unfortunately, I feel like people get really nervous about that now because of the cost, the nature of the cost. So one of the things, and the reasons that I am such a complete and crazy fan about Measure 98 is making sure that we're pushing those college and career explorations back to high school level. so that you can then they can have a better idea where their path is, so they can spend their dollars wisely. So when they go into community college, so I'm wondering. My question's coming. Sorry, I had to make the. So my question is, I'm wondering what kind of data do we back up to when we find out that students are leaving, the retention rate changes. Is there ability moving forward to finding out what kind of reasons are those students not finishing the program? And
Chair Reardon, Representative Solman, understanding why students don't retain is one of the more difficult questions in higher education research, because when the students leave, they're not very easy to contact. I think in general, we know that particularly with community college students, it's often non-academic reasons that cause them to leave the institution. I think we hear anecdotally the broken down car, the inability to find child care. Those things are what often cause a student to depart from the institution. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that we have good data about at the state level, nor do we have an easy way to really, really track that.
Thank you. John?
Thank you. Right, I'm going to use a cheat sheet here. First time here, so I'll see if I can get this right. Chair Reardon, Vice Chairs Winsent and Alonzo Leon, members of the committee. For the record, John Hamblin, Executive Dean, Student Development at Mount Hood Community College. So I think a couple pieces I want to frame before I get into what Mount Hood did. We have a couple beliefs about our students. One of them is students don't know what they don't know, but we behave as though they should. The second piece is around freedom to fail and right to succeed. And so we utilize those mentality, philosophy, and a lot of the work that we do. We have a lot of programming to support students, and there isn't a week that goes by that I don't have a member of our community or a member of our board ask me, so what is it? What is that one thing that you're doing that's really helping these students out? And my response is always, it's never one thing. It's always multiple things. So we do a lot of stuff is usually my response in that question. What this funding through House Bill 4076 was able to do was expand on that lot of stuff that we're doing, which we actually know works, but we always struggle with the scalability of a lot of that functionality within our systems. What we start off every year with is an amazing welcome day. We usually have about 1,000 students attend our welcome day. It's optional, and I want to thank Representative Johnson for being there, because we actually made a session very specific to our Oregon Promise students, and he got to speak and hear the thank yous and applause from about 350 of our 600 Oregon Promise students for fall term. Right from that moment on, we decided to celebrate with our students this opportunity that they had for Oregon Promise funding, and we wanted to support and coach them like we're unable to do for so many of our students, because funding becomes that key issue. We have a number of amazing programs. We started it off with the Welcome Day. We had an Oregon Promise party, had a radio station come in, had pizza, had club and activity fairs, all the support services that we offer on campus. We put together a career fair for these students to see exactly what we have. We made a lot of phone calls. We sent a lot of emails. We did a huge amount of outreach, and we continue to do that throughout this year. When I speak about building off existing programs, we are an AVID school. We've been for a number of years. There's a lot of very, very successful strategies through AVID that really this provided us an opportunity to expand on. One of those simple strategies was expanding of our human development courses. We call it the HD100 course. I've got a couple items on that course that we're really trying to focus on. We're trying to develop skills around persistence, self-control, conscientiousness, develop some self-efficacy skills. And really the students are coming to us, they don't have a lot of those skills and abilities. And so this is a real good opportunity for us to engage with them, interact with them, and actually mandate the course as well too for them. So we made some decisions on not only offering more sections of that class with a part of our funding, but we also did a lot of workshops to support these students. So it wasn't just a one time, I kind of call it, you replace your roof hopefully every 20, maybe 50 years. You take care of your lawn and you have to mow it and you have to maintain it and you have to fertilize it. So it's a very different scenario than replacing that roof. We can't just do this once and think it's going to be good forever. So that's why the importance behind continued funding exists as well, too. We know this helped. It's going to help this year as students. If we can't continue funding moving forward, we're likely not going to be able to provide the same level of service, and we'd have to look at scaling back as well, too. Another question that was asked is about surveying our students. We were very, very active in surveying our students. We surveyed them the moment we knew from OSAC who they were. We surveyed them multiple times throughout the year in every event that we have, and we're receiving about a 40% response rate on surveys. And any of you that have ever issued a survey, that's phenomenal response rate. We throw a little incentive out there as well, too, which I think helps, but we're getting some real honest feedback from the students. Honest feedback about what services are they utilizing, what is making the difference for them. A couple key pieces, academic advisors. We hired two additional academic advisors not associated with the Oregon Promise funds, but we had more advising support to interact and impact these students, be more intrusive, be more proactive. Rather than waiting for them to come to us, we were able to reach out and communicate with them. We also did some training for our advisors as well. We also sense that they, in the survey responses, they have more of a feeling of belonging, because a lot of the activities and events that we did were community building events, which are very, very instrumental in a college student success. Universities will usually take about a week with their students, welcome week. We don't have admissions criteria for our students. You don't have a minimum GPA. We are open access, and we traditionally will show students with lower GPAs coming into college. So we need to have more time, attention, and care to provide to those students. So being able to do this through this Oregon Promise funding actually helped us see major differences in average GPA. Similar to Chemeketa, we're seeing about a 3.2 GPA, where our traditional students are coming in, and after their first two terms are around a 2.9, so they're 0.3 GPA points stronger than our traditional non-Oregon Promise students. And a lot of this is associated with all the support that we're doing for these students as well, too. That wraparound holistic support really, truly makes a difference. Of the surveying, we also heard from them they really appreciate the phone calls and the texts and the emails that we're sending them. They appreciate feeling like a person and not feeling like a number as well, too. So that was really, really huge. When we talk about where the funding went, we also utilize a lot of our own people, a lot of our own supports, and a lot of our own services that exist already, but we are able to scale up and able to expand and dedicate additional time and energy towards the activities that we were able to do. With the AVID program, this is another piece too. They've been putting on a summer bridge program for the last 4 years. The summer bridge, the very first year we did it, we had minimal funding to be able to do this. We had 18 students go through the summer bridge program. It's a two-day intensive program, and they're showing them all those college skills, college knowledge, and really trying to work with them to develop the skills that they're going to be successful as a student, and there's follow-up activity with that. That first year we had 18 students. We've expanded, and with the funding from House Bill 4076, we were able to expand last year to 160 students. Mm-hmm. And a very large percentage, about 80% of those students, were actual Oregon Promise students as well, too. And with the funding, we were able to increase not just a summer bridge before the start of fall term, but we've been doing in-between term bridge programs as well, too. And we're seeing astronomical growth in the retention of those students as well as our non-Oregon Promise students. So a lot of these support services, we're using online orientation, in-person orientation. We're mandating online orientation. So this has actually allowed us to kind of kickstart, because we have really, really solid results that are showing you're doing this. Here's a result. It's positive. It makes it a lot easier for institutional change as well, too. Learning communities are another big component of our AVID program, and the learning communities really take one class, pair it with another class, and potentially a college success class, to where the instructors are not on different islands teaching the students, but they're working together, and they understand what's happening between classes and communicate about assignments, skills that are developed in the class, and complement each other in every way they can. Alongside that, our Learning Success Center and AVID Center actually provide supports as well, too, to complement that in-classroom experience for the students. So we're able to scale all of that up. We're actually able to identify our Oregon Promise students, which sometimes is a challenge when you have 10,000 new students coming every year, to actually identify and gear these students towards the best and most appropriate support services. So when I say we do a lot of stuff, I talk really fast, and you probably just heard a lot of stuff. So I'm open to any questions.
Any questions? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm just reviewing the report really fast. Had a very, very busy week. Wanted to, I've scanned through it. Can you tell me of the Oregon Promise recipients, how many of them are first-generation students? I see a lot of great work around first-year students, but wanted to know what percentage of these students are first-generation students.
Chair Reardon, Representative Alonzo Leon, I believe that information is available self-reported from students' FAFSA. It is not contained within this report, but that information should be available from OSAC, and we can provide that along with the information about GED students.
Awesome. Thank you.
Other questions? It's really exciting. It does kind of beg the question. I'm trying to get some bills through on improved counseling at the high school level, and very frustrating trying to get support for something we know that works, but so we're not doing it there because we can't afford it, but you're doing a lot of the skill building, helping students develop some of their basic skills at your level, so it's really interesting how we can afford to do it as a community college level, but we can't afford to do it earlier. So anyway, just an observation. No response required.
Thank you, Chair.
This is just amazing to hear the results that you're getting, and thank you so much for what you're doing. And I feel really thankful to a couple of the people who have been on this committee for a long time, even longer than I have, Rep. Johnson and Wisnett, that kind of helped come up with some of these ideas and really bring them to fruition. So it's really a joy to be here with them and hear of the success of the work. So thank you for sharing that. But I did hear we need to continue the funding. It's just a little bit.
A little bit.
So $83,000?
Well, there's still money left to be funded in the second year of the biennium. It hasn't, all the 1.8 hasn't been completely allotted yet. So it'll be carrying forward. But yeah, right? Correct?
Representative Reardon, or Chair Reardon, Representative Johnson, at this point, as of the end of March, 64.2, I think about 65% of the funding had been spent. The colleges had plans to expend the remainder by the end of the biennium.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
So if they don't, then we would take it back and then reallocate.
But I would just the bang for the buck, I think, is pretty undeniable.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about it really is.
It's amazing.
House Bill 4076 only had $1.8 million in it. So as you think about the other investments we make in a lot of other programs, and you can hear some of the excitement and the results that are coming from this, targeted investments in the right programs can be very effective.
Yeah. I like it. Well, I thank you. If there are no other questions, we'll appreciate your being here and sharing this, and good luck going forward.
Thank you.
I'm closing this informational hearing.
Awesome partner.
And opening an informational hearing on college affordability initiatives for baccalaureate degrees. We have Sean Pollock.
3-year program that they could have done for 1.8 for all 17 colleges. It's amazing.
And thanks for being here, Sean. And if you just introduce yourself for the record, and it's all yours.
Thank you. Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Alonzo Leon, and Vice Chair Wisnett, and members of the committee. I'm Sean Pollock, and I'm an academic policy specialist with HEC's Office of University Coordination. And on behalf of the agency, I want to thank you for this opportunity to review some of our recent research and reporting on affordable baccalaureate degree programs here in Oregon and in other states. So, as you know, affordability is a pillar of HEC's strategic plan, and it's one of the central challenges that all of our institutions face. It's the main challenge of our student populations. So, along with you here in the legislature, the agency, HEC, and the commission are committed to making sure that financial need isn't a bar to accessing high-quality public post-secondary education. And so, as part of our report on House Bill 2973 from 2015, we focused on several affordability options and innovations. Among those were fixed-cost degree programs, the programs known as $10,000 degree programs as currently exist in Texas and Florida, and on a few specific programs in Oregon at our public universities that focus on cutting costs for the student by leveraging available aid and by cutting time to degree. The best known, so to talk about the fixed cost program first, the best known and the, arguably the most successful of these is Western Governors University, which allows its students to take as many credits as they are able for approximately $3,000 per term. That means that students can challenge their way out of courses if they feel they know what they need to know to pass and get the credit for the course. That also means that they have a policy of offering credit for prior learning as well. Western Governors is accredited by the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, as are all of the other Oregon public institutions. So they are bound by that 25% cap on credit for prior learning that the same that also affects the Oregon public institutions as well. Their price model is feasible in part due to a lack of in-person teaching and campus infrastructure. All their instruction takes place either online or with students conferring remotely with academic course mentors and advisors. To move to the $10,000 degree baccalaureate programs have been launched in Texas and Florida. In Texas, there are two programs currently operating that serve small cohorts of students at rural state institutions. One's a program for in organizational leadership for adults with prior learning. So it's similar to the fixed cost or the credit for prior learning model. Another separate program is a STEM degrees program that is science, technology, engineering, math for very well-prepared high school students, so that it's first-time freshmen. Both of these programs can cost the have a sticker price, if you will, between $8,000 and $14,000. So they meet many of the definitions of affordability. However, these programs are new, so we don't have a lot of data yet on their enrollment, on their degree production, their outcomes for their students. They have yet to produce significant numbers of graduates. I think both of these programs got underway in 2014, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm sorry, Sean, is that $10,000 per year or
no,
$10,000 total?
That's total.
Total.
That's
okay. Total. So that's their advertised sticker price, if you will, is $10,000. So $2,500 per year for in the case of the University of Texas Permian Basin science and engineering degrees.
Okay.
But the combined output of these programs won't exceed 1% of Texas's annual baccalaureate output in the next few years, just because they're very small programs. They're experimental. They're innovative. They're new. Right. Florida as well has launched $10,000 degree programs at its state colleges, the Florida State Colleges, which in many respects are similar to the community colleges in Oregon, except they can grant baccalaureate degrees in certain fields. It's important to note that the Florida State Colleges are the most affordable already in the state of Florida as well. Again, the enrollment in these programs, they're $10,000 degree programs. The enrollment numbers haven't been widely published. We've been looking for them. But again, they represent a very, very small fraction of the total enrollment for the state. The total state Florida State College system enrolls approximately 800,000 students. So we're talking, you know, a few hundred to a couple of thousand students at most right now. So these are innovative, interesting programs. They have a very low sort of sticker price. They also share some interesting features in common besides the lower price, that in each state, the sort of the $10,000 degree challenge, if you will, was a policy priority for the state's governors in Rick Scott in Florida. He ran for president. Texas, I forgot his name.
Rick Perry,
thank you so much. I apologize. Thank you, Representative.
That came from a Democrat.
So each was a policy priority for those governors. They required high levels of philanthropic and state subsidy. So in Florida, I think the state legislature allocated something like $5 million to help those programs start up. And there was about a three-year process, I guess, for designing those programs and implementing them. And again, they serve very small cohorts of students. So they're innovative, they're interesting, and they have those other things in mind, as key features. To talk about some Oregon-specific programs now, the public universities are also meeting that affordability challenge with their own institutional initiatives, and we've highlighted a few examples in that report on House Bill 2973, and I'll just briefly mention a couple of those here. Portland State University recently launched a 4 years free program. I think it started in 2016, and that program subsidizes Pell-eligible students with a last dollar type of scholarship similar to the Oregon Promise. Provided those students are first-time freshmen and they have a relatively high GPA in high school, and they follow a fairly prescriptive academic pathway, so it helps them to finish in 4 years, and it subsidizes the whatever that the Pell and other state aid does not cover. Southern Oregon University as well has an accelerated baccalaureate program that can cut about 25% off the expected price of a four-year degree by basically cutting out a year's worth of coursework because they take a very high credit load. But again, they also have academic eligibility requirements. And I also wanted to mention that Portland State and Oregon Tech are also making significant efforts to aid students who are close to degree but may have stopped out for a variety of usually financial reasons. So, for example, PSU's Last Mile program uses degree audits to find students who are close to degree but have been out of their academic program for whatever reason. And Oregon Tech, similarly, also offers college completer scholarships for students who might have high levels of debt. They may have maxed out their available aid, but they are also fairly close to degree, so they offer them, scholarships to the students to help them finish up their degree. These programs recognize that the truly unaffordable degree is one that's left unfinished, and where the long-term economic benefits are unrealizable. We also want to note that it's important to note that House Bill 2973 passed into law in 2015, before the Oregon Promise was fully established, and as you've heard and as you know, that program's really changed the conversation in our state surrounding affordability. The broader availability of financial assistance in that last dollar program like Oregon Promise makes other non-financial initiatives more important than ever in ensuring that students are able to finish their intended degree programs with as few excess credits, with as little, without unnecessary debt or unnecessary delays. So, and you've heard actually just from our previous speakers how important those other supports are. So to create true affordability, financial support has to be conjoined with all the necessary advisory and academic supports that help students choose courses wisely and help them find their passion that leads to a successful academic pathway. And with that, I'll say thanks for the opportunity to present. And if you have questions, I can answer them. And Kyle Thomas, our Director of Legislative Affairs, can also answer them.
Questions? I'm just kind of curious about the PSU program in terms of how that works. And just do they go through as a cohort, or are they so that they're always assured that the course they need is available?
Chair Reardon, thank you for the question. I can't answer that first question. I do know that they have a four-year degree guarantee that I think works on more on a cohort model, but I can find the answer for you.
I just know that we've had sometimes one of the reasons somebody can't get through the program in four years is just unavailable classes. So just wondered how they were addressing that in that situation.
I know that Chair Reardon, I know that PSU's four-year degree guarantee, which is a different program but similarly structured in that it's very prescriptive, that if the student can't find the classes they need on their pathway, they are not penalized for that financially, so they are able to get them later, and they are not penalized financially for not being able to.
But it would still take longer?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And real quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pollack, do you know who sponsored House Bill 2976 or 72?
Chair Reardon, Vice Chair, I do know, sir.
Let me tell you that HEC played a big role. Dana Richardson helped me work this bill so the presidents would be receptive to it. We started off with just a $10,000 degree from Texas, and we made it affordable. But I think it's real important. And what was real important is the four-year presidents didn't say no to this. They came back with suggestions. And it's really building up on what we're doing with the Oregon Promise. We said we're not asking you to have go to 4 years at University of Oregon for $10,000. It was a pathway coming in with so many high school credits, going to community college, and then being sure you don't lose credits as you get into the four-year universities. This committee, for the time that Representative Johnson and I have sat on it since it was created in 2009-11, we continue to push for making tuition less expensive. And I think that we should continue to do this. You know, maybe we're not going to get a $10,000 degree, but hopefully we can get a $20,000 or $14,000 or whatever. And we should continue to work for that. That's what the legislature should do with the help of the HEC and the universities. We had a bill this session. We also introduced it that we dropped out. And so I'd ask Mr. Pollack to talk about whether we should bring this back as the Western Governors University. Mm-hmm. We're a signatory to that, I understand, but it's going to be hard to do. I think I was advised by, I think it was Dana, that they don't have an office here, so that makes it, and all they have to do is have an office, and we could look at implementing that program. And it's basically an online school, but very successful, and I still think it's possibly a lot more of the future of higher education in America. Could you comment on the Western Gun?
Thank you, Vice Chair Risnett and Chair Reardon. Only to say that you're absolutely right that Western Governors was in part hatched here in Oregon and in seven other Western states and their governors. I do know that Washington and Indiana, I believe, have state-branded partnerships with Western Governors, so that I believe makes them eligible for state-level financial aid, and that's the lack of, as you say, the lack of an office here in Oregon, yes. That and the lack of a formalized state-level partnership.
That's the reason we dropped that degree, so all we need to do is work on that. Getting an office.
So I'm sorry, I'm behind everybody else. I have not read the report. Is there, are the recommended next things that we'd like to try?
That was not one of the recommendations. Okay. Chair Reardon.
It was interesting. I was in the, had the lady from Starbucks in the other day, and they will provide their employees with, pay their tuition to the University of Phoenix, which is an online course, and they're having good success with that. So, I don't know. It's great to have visibility, some of these options. Mm-hmm. Like, keep pushing on that. Any other questions, comments? I think we're ready to call it a day. Thank you so much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your coming in. Before I close this, thank Rep. Wisnett for his standing in and opening the meeting.
Oh, impromptu. You should have seen all the stuff he passed.
I'm closing the informational hearing. It's scary. I'm closing a meeting of the House Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee. Let's call it a week. Development Committee.